Okay, so my name is Michael Peskin. I'm from Slack out on the left coast. The title of this series of talks is Standard Model. Obviously, there's no time to discuss the whole standard model in six lectures. So this is kind of going to be a boot camp on the theoretical basis of collider physics. I've been told that some part of you are experimenters and another part of you are people who've just had quantum field theory. So the theoretical level is actually going to be rather basic. On the other hand, I'll be around all week. So if you have more sophisticated questions, you can ask me. If you have really sophisticated questions about collider physics, you should ask Mary Angela and Itai, who are actually the big experts here. What I wanted to do is to present really the kind of first elements of quantum field theory that you need to know in order to understand how the standard model works at high energy colliders, and in particular at LHC. And so the presentation will be very much geared to that. So the outline of the lectures is basically the following. First, I want to just review the structure of the electroweak theory, which is going to be very important to us, and at the same time, introduce some basic, pretty simple methods that we're going to use to analyze high energy reactions. In the second lecture, we'll talk about the parton model. In the third lecture, we'll talk about something called Altarelli-Parisi or Deglop evolution, which is a kind of governing principle for extrapolating from low energies to high energies in QCD. In the fourth lecture, I'll try and wrap all these things up by explaining to you how the principles that we've discussed so far lead to the kind of events that you see actually at the LHC. The fifth lecture will discuss some very interesting theoretical principle called the Goldstone boson equivalence theorem. And the sixth lecture, I'll tell you what we know about the Higgs boson. And from that, you can infer what we don't know, which is a lot, and maybe start working on that. Okay, here we go. In these lectures, I'm going to emphasize particle interactions at high energy. And so the basic tool that we're going to use is to compute the amplitudes of massless particles with definite polarization, definite spin orientation, and the emphasis on the massless, because that makes everything simple. And so in this way, we'll try and kind of get the most easy to understand, the most basic formulae, and then using that technology, we'll just try and apply it everywhere and see where we get to. So let me just establish some notation first. So we start out with the Dirac equation, the Lagrangian of the Dirac field, I gamma dot d minus m psi. Well, first of all, I'm going to go to the high energy limit, so we forget about the mass term. I'm going to take as my basis of gamma matrices this one, so the one in which the gamma 5 operator is diagonal. So this is a very convenient basis for dealing with massless fermions. Sigma mu is I sigma, Pauli sigma matrices, and sigma bar mu is 1 minus sigma. In this basis, gamma, this is psi bar gamma times gamma 0 is diagonal with respect to the two-component space that I've listed here. So we can decompose capital psi into two pieces, a left-handed and a right-handed piece, and the whole thing falls apart into two independent terms. So if I just now write this in this basis, psi minus I sigma dm psi minus plus psi plus I sigma m dm psi plus. So when you quantize these fields, psi minus is the one which destroys the left-handed electrons and it creates the left-handed positrons. And psi plus is the one that destroys the right-handed electrons and creates left-handed positrons. These objects being the antiparticles of one another. And so now, in four dimensions, there isn't much distinction between right and left-handed. If I take psi plus, for example, complex conjugate it and multiply it by sigma 2, I get some other object, phi minus, that transforms as a left-handed particle. So that's just the statement that I could as well view the complex conjugate of this as the thing that destroys the left-handed positrons and creates the right-handed electrons. But in these lectures, I'm just going to do it this way. The left-handed leptons and quarks are here. The right-handed leptons and quarks are here. And we'll try and analyze them. Okay. Oh, let's see. So now we should look at the wave functions associated with these particles. So this is probably something I want to save. So let me put this over here. So if I now solve the Dirac equation for a left-handed particle, the solution will be something like this. Psi minus is equal to u left of p e to the minus I p dot x, or v left of p e to the plus I p dot x, where u and v satisfy the equation p dot sigma bar is equal to 0. And if you just write this out, let's say for p parallel to the 3 direction, this is going to be something like 0, maybe I should actually do this. There we go. So the solution will be something like u is equal to, that's a plus sign. U is equal to this, and v, which satisfies the same equation, is equal to the same thing. Now I have to normalize this, the normalization condition will be u dagger u is equal to 2e. P, and so a square root of 2EP appears in front of this. If I now want the solution for an arbitrary orientation, this is a two-component spinner, you just rotate it. And so U of P, or VL of P, is the square root of 2EP times cosine theta over 2 minus sine theta over 2, where what I've done is to rotate the axis of the particle away from the 3 axis. So this is all very straightforward stuff. You've seen it in like the second day of your quantum field theory course. But it's very important because given a formula like this, you can learn all kinds of things about how particles behave at colliders. So please commit this formula to memory, and we'll use it again and again as we go through the course. Now, the most basic process at high-energy colliders is the current-current interaction, which we're going to see in many different guises here. It's basically the single exchange of a vector boson between two fermions. So the simplest example of that is electron-positron annihilation, let's say, to a muon and a right-handed muon. In quantum electrodynamics, you see this with a photon, in the electroweak theory with a photon plus Z. In other processes, this vector boson might be a gluon if it's between quarks. It might be exchanged in the T-channel as opposed to the S-channel. But this reaction is absolutely central to a lot of things that happen at colliders. And so it's probably worth just spending a little time trying to understand the whole structure of this for the case of E plus E minus to mu plus mu minus, just to get all the formulae straight in our heads. Let me now work this out in detail using the formula that I wrote up there. So just in quantum electrodynamics, and now I'm going to explicitly choose left-handed polarization here and left-handed polarization here. The formula looks like this. There's a minus I e squared. There's a 1 over q squared if I just have a photon here. And then there are these spinner products. So for the muon, sigma m v, and for the electron, v dagger, sigma m u. And okay. Now, let's just take a moment to work out explicitly what the structure of this object is. So UL is associated with the annihilation of a left-handed electron. VL is associated with, because it's dagger, the annihilation of the right-handed positron. So that's the thing that makes up the initial state here. VL sigma U is the square root of, and let's now work in the center of mass system. The electron's coming in this way. The muon's going out this way, and that angle will be theta. 2EP squared. The electron coming in along the 3-axis has exactly the spinner that I've written up there. For the positron, we need to be a little careful. It's the direction of the positron is opposite. So the spin gets rotated through pi. Rotating a spinner through pi moves it to the upper component. And then this spin looks like it's a right-handed spin. Namely, the spin is pointed, this spinner corresponds to this spin. But remember, this is the antiparticle. So the physical spin of the antiparticle is the opposite of this. So indeed, what we have is a left-handed electron and a right-handed positron. Okay, in between, we write the sigma, which is 1 minus sigma. And now we can just compute this. 2EP is the same as the center of mass energy. 1 has no expectation value. 1, let's see. This one picks up a minus I, no. And 0, why am I confused? Yeah, no, that's perfect. Okay. And we can write this equally well as 2EP, or the square root of S, the center of mass energy, times the square root of 2, times 1 over root 2, times epsilon left of p. And this vector is the left-handed polarization vector spin 1. So roughly, this vector is a polarization vector that signals spin 1 along the 3-axis. So there's nothing very complicated here. What this does is just tell you that the initial massless electron and positron with these spin orientations creates a virtual photon that carries spin 1 along the beam direction. To calculate this thing, it's more or less the same calculation. If you want a nice exercise, you could do it in the rotated frame, but if you just have theta equals 0, it's pretty obvious what it's going to be. U dagger sigma m v is the square root of s, the square root of 2, 1 over root 2, and the same vector complex conjugated. And then for general theta, all we have to do is rotate that vector. sorry. That's now correctly normalized. And this shouldn't be here. And if I just rotate this vector through that rotation, it'll be 1 cosine theta. It's the complex conjugate, so it'll be I and minus sine theta. Well, now, it's the Perimeter Institute. They understand anti-gravity here. Now, we're already set up to understand, at least in this simple context, some angular distributions. So, for example, if I try and compute that whole matrix element, which is kind of in the dark there, I would do that by dotting these two elements into each other. I'd get something like S times 2 times the, there's square roots of 2 being left out and included, but this is the correct normalization for the polarization vector. There are square roots of 2 that are being omitted, but you see, you're going to get something like 1 plus cosine theta. Maybe there's an overall minus sign that I've missed. Please excuse me. And the 2, and there's a half. Okay, now we're cooking. Q squared is S, so the whole thing is minus I is E squared. 1 plus cosine theta. So if I then look at the cross section, d sigma d cosine theta, this is going to be proportional to the square of that. So there's a 1 plus cosine theta squared angular distribution. This is the angular distribution for e minus left, e plus right, going to mu minus left, mu plus right. It'll also, by parity, be the angular distribution for the right-handed electrons, turning into right-handed muons. If I flip the spin here but not here, the effect of that is to change the sign of this guy here, or maybe I should say this guy here, to I. So then it'll flip over to a 1 minus cosine theta distribution. And that'll be what we have for E left, E plus right, going to mu minus right, mu plus left, and the other way around. Now, this particular angular distribution is seen all over particle physics, and in particular in two very important places. First of all, when you have E plus E minus annihilation, these are the angular distributions that you see. In QED, what you see is the average of these two distributions, which is a 1 plus cosine theta squared distribution. And that's something you can visualize in a way that we're going to discuss in just a moment. When we have QED plus electroweak, you have some mixture of these with different coefficients because the electroweak theory is a parity non-conserving theory. And by measuring the extent of this with respect to this, the forward-backward asymmetry in the reaction, then you can immediately see parity violation in the weak interactions. The other place that you see this, which is very important in collider physics, is in the polarization of vector bosons. So as we'll discuss in more detail, probably in the fourth lecture, a process that you might have is the so-called Drell-Yan process. QQ bar annihilation into a W boson or a Z boson. And in those cases, the angular momentum physics is the same. You have a vector boson. You have two essentially massless fermions in the initial state. for a W boson, what annihilates is a left-handed up quark against a right-handed anti-down quark. So actually, the angular momentum physics is exactly the same as what I wrote up there, and the angular distribution should be the same. If the W now decays to a lepton and the neutrino, the distribution of the neutrino will be exactly this 1 plus cosine theta distribution. So maybe it's worth actually trying to record alongside those formulae, these formulae, d gamma d cosine theta for various kinds of W boson decays. I see I made a little mistake here, because when you discuss W boson decays, of course, you can't see the neutrino, but you can see the lepton. So it's more useful maybe to define the angle theta, the decay angle, to be the angle from the, let's say, the 3 direction where the lepton is. The lepton for a W plus is a right-handed particle, and so these angular distributions get reversed. But let me now try and record these three cases. For a left-handed W created, for example, by QQ bar annihilation at a high-energy collider like the LHC, the left-handed W will decay to this distribution, except we'll have to trade theta for minus theta. So this will be 1 minus cosine theta squared. The W right decays to 1 plus cosine theta squared. And then, of course, a massive W also has a third polarization state. The one, so this corresponds to epsilon W equals 1 over root 2, 0, 1, I, 0, sorry, minus I. Here, epsilon W is 1 over root 2, 0, 1, I, W. There's a third polarization state, which we're going to discuss in great detail in the lecture 5 of this series, which is the one that only exists for a massive W, where you have longitudinal polarization. And I think you can guess that what appears here is a central type distribution, sine squared theta. So it's interesting. From this knowledge of the current-current interaction, you can immediately infer these angular distributions, that if you have a W at the LHC, say, decaying to a lepton that you observe, depending on the polarization of the W, the lepton is extremely forward peaked. This is cosine theta from 1 to minus 1, extremely backward peaked or central. And as the course proceeds, we'll use this idea to do polarization analysis on W's that we could find at any collider. And I think it's actually, this is actually a very important tool when you start doing phenomenology at the LHC. Okay, now, how are we doing? We've discussed the kind of basic spinology of this current-current interaction, and at the same time, we've tried to understand the angular distributions that you find when you have actual physical vector bosons that you produce at colliders. So maybe the next thing to do is to talk about the electroweak interactions. So let me now write in a convenient form the standard model coupling of fermions to electroweak interactions and derive some properties of the W and Z bosons. So the way you couple fermions to vector bosons in the standard model is through the covariant derivative. The covariant derivative, d mu, is very abstractly, G times A mu A sigma A over 2. Well, let me just write here TA minus IG prime B and the hypercharge. Actually, let's call this IA. That's probably a good notation. So this is the charge under the SU2 part of the electroweak interactions, the weak isospin. This is the charge under the U1 part, the hypercharge. And depending on what I and Y are, you get very different couplings for the various species, up quarks, down quarks, leptons, or neutrinos. I hope you've all done the exercise of converting this formula to the mass basis for vector bosons in the standard model. So when you break the symmetry of the standard model, A and B turn into the more familiar states, W plus, W minus, Z and gamma. And this formula turns into the following very convenient formula. D mu minus, minus IE times the electric charge times A mu minus IG over the square root of 2 times W plus I plus plus W minus I minus. So that's the charge-changing weak interaction. And then for the Z, the coupling is the following. I3 minus SW squared times Q, where in the notation that I've been using, SW is the sine of the angle theta W, CW is the cosine of the angle theta W. Then, and please remember the mass relation, MW over MZ is cosine theta W, or just CW in this notation. Okay, this is a very important formula. It applies to all quarks and leptons. It actually applies to anything. As long as SU2 cross U1 is a good gauge interaction, any new particle should be assigned some definite SU2 cross U1 quantum numbers, and then you can work out its interactions from this formula. Now, the first thing we can do from that formula, which is very straightforward, is to derive the properties of the vector bosons. So, for example, if we have a W boson that can decay to two fermions, first of all, the W only couples to things that have SU2, so it only couples to the left-handed fermions and right-handed antifermions. We can write the matrix element for that decay just by reading off that formula. It's IG over root 2 times, well, that's it. U dagger sigma m v, left-handed, dotted into the polarization vector of the W. So what sits here is the same structure that we found up there. It's just the left-handed polarization vector in the direction where the fermions are going. And so this yields directly these same formulae, 1 plus cosine theta, 1 minus cosine theta, et cetera. If you want the total rate, you square this. So this is g squared over 2. The square of this vector will be basically, what is it, 2, and s here is mw squared. If I polarization average, there's also a third because I've squared the vector rather than dotting it with a particular polarization state. And so then I think we can just write down the formula for the width of the W into a particular fermion-antifermion state, 1 over 8 pi sorry, 1 over 2mw, 1 over 8 pi for phase space, this formula, g squared mw. There's a 1/3 for the polarization average when you compute the square of this formula. And I think we're pretty much done here. G squared over 4 pi, 1/6, 1/12, mw, and that's it. This formula applies to any species of lepton, and it applies to each color of the quark. So for a quark, you'd multiply this by 3. Okay. Now, to evaluate these formulae, you need to know what the standard model couplings are. That is, their actual values. And so maybe it's worth a little digression on that. One of the things I like to do when I teach particle physics is to start out by explaining how different in strength all the interactions of nature appear to be, and then explaining that when you look at things in the right way, all the interactions of nature turn out to be of, well, roughly the same scale, expressed in terms of dimensionless numbers. These numbers are all of the same order of magnitude, and you can actually just write them down on the blackboard once and for all. In these lectures, we'll be talking about collider physics, that is, physics at the 100 GeV scale. So it's appropriate to normalize all couplings at some 100 GeV type number. What's conventional is the mass of the Z, so that's 91 GeV. At that value, we can write the various couplings, alpha S, which I'll get to in a minute, alpha W, which is g squared over 4 pi, the same g as I wrote over there, alpha W prime, or alpha prime, which is g prime squared over 4 pi. There's a derived quantity alpha. Something else which is interesting is alpha T, which is the top quark Yukawa coupling divided by 4 pi. And basically, all of the interactions that you meet in collider physics are just proportional to these dimensionless numbers. So maybe it's good to just fill in their values. The values I'm going to fill in are appropriate to sine squared theta W equals 0.231. How that's obtained, we'll talk about in just a moment. So this one is 1 over 29.6. It's known quite accurately. This one is 1 over 98. Alpha S, which is GS squared over 4 pi. Of course, the strong interactions are also a Young-Mills theory, QCD. This is 1 over 8.4 at this value. You probably know that this runs strongly with the renormalization group. We'll talk about that a little later in the lectures. The value of alpha that you should put in is 128. It's not 137. The reason for that is that the 137, which is the value of the electric charge, and of course, this is e squared over 4 pi, the value of the electric charge at large distances is screened by the fact that there are light quarks and leptons. If you go to the Z mass scale, you get inside the screening cloud of the light quarks and leptons, and then the electromagnetic coupling appears somewhat stronger. And the correct value when you work it all out is something like this. And then finally, the interactions, the Yukawa couplings of light quarks are typically not very important at colliders, but the top quark coupling is often very important. This number is, I think I didn't write it down in my notes, but it's about 1 over 12. Like that. Do you remember that? Okay. I might correct that a little later in the lecture. Please excuse me. But it's of the same order of magnitude as the rest of these numbers. In fact, the fact that this number is like the second largest number on the list is very important for theories of electroweak symmetry breaking, which maybe will be discussed, not in my lectures, but maybe in other lectures in the school. Yeah, this is about right. This is 1, 4 pi is 12, so that's about right. Okay. Good. Anyway, now with that information in hand, we're ready to plug into this formula. And now actually we have the more or less the complete profile of the W boson. W to E nu, the same thing with mu nu and tau nu. Gamma is alpha weak, MW over 12. For W goes to UD bar or CS bar. The gamma is, well, first of all, 3 times that because there are colors. And then there's an additional QCD radiative correction, which often should be included, alpha S of MW over pi. And there's some longer series here. This is about a 3% correction. And so from those numbers, you can then extract the total width of the W boson and the various branching ratios. So for a lepton, the branching ratio is 11%. For a quark species, 34%. So 2 times that plus 3 times that adds up to 1. And the total width is, if I remember correctly, 2.1 GeV. So knowing these numbers and the structure of the standard model, you immediately reach these conclusions. And this more or less describes the whole phenomenology. This plus the angular distributions that I wrote for you before gives you the whole phenomenology of W bosons at the LHC. I had in the notes some beautiful event pictures of W bosons. Let me just pause again. How many of you did actually succeed in downloading lecture 1 from this site? Okay, so if you go to page, I'm not sure, it's about page 12, you'll see some very beautiful event pictures taken at the LEP collider, which, let's just say, before there was the LHC, there was something else in that enormous tunnel at CERN, which was an E plus E minus collider operating at 200 GeV. And that collider studied the process E plus E minus to W pairs, which we'll have more to say about in lecture 5. And some sample event pictures from that reaction are shown here. The first one is a E plus E minus to W plus W minus decay with both W's decaying to leptons. The second one, a very beautiful event where you see two jets and a single isolated charge track. That is interpreted as a W decay to QQ bar and a W decay to tau plus tau minus. And then the third one is a four-jet event with the two event pairs each summing to the W mass. So that's another way to visualize the W in these reactions. Good. Now, if we want to understand the Z boson, we just basically have to carry out the same exercise with the Z. And that's not so hard. So, oh my god, the fundamental constants are unfortunately on a blackboard that's going to be hidden by all the others. Okay, please excuse me. Maybe I can just trade this for this. Okay. For the Z, it's not so hard to do the same exercise. It's more or less identical to what we just did. We just have to, instead of this formula, get the analogous formula in the following way. The partial width for the Z to some chiral fermion, always, is 1 over 8 pi, 1 over 2mz, so this is the prefactor, the phase space, the square of the matrix element, according to the coupling that I wrote up there, will include an e squared and a cosine squared theta, sine squared theta. And then it will include the, there's a 1/3 for the polarization average, and then it will include the z charge. And the z charge, let me call it qz, has this interesting formula, I3 minus sine squared theta w times q, that we'll discuss in a moment, and this comes squared. So just to rearrange that formula into a more convenient setting, gamma for z to ff bar is, let me write e squared over sw squared is alpha w, as I've defined it here. Alpha w over cosine squared theta w. There's a 6 instead of a 12, because there's a square root of 2 that is omitted in this calculation, mz times qz squared. Now you can plug in the qz's and work out what all the branching ratios are of the z. And this is actually a good exercise to do, as it were, tactily, because the z has a very interesting decay pattern, interesting in many respects. The way I like to present it is as a table. And let me write that table for you here. Or what can I, let's annihilate this blackboard and write the table here. So now, this is such a lovely thing, because the values of these parameters, qz, are very different for the different quarks and leptons. Also, because I3 is there for left-handed particles but not right-handed particles, it's different for the left and right-handed spin states of the various fermions. And so a nice way to write it is like this. The qz left, the qz right, and I'm going to define some quantities SF and AF. And we can look at this for neutrinos, for electrons, for up quarks, and for down quarks. Now, SF is the sum of the squares . So that determines the total rate of a z decay into each particle. The AF is QZL squared minus QZR squared over QZL squared plus QZR squared. So this determines the asymmetry, that is, the preponderance of left-handed over right-handed states. And what's interesting when you actually work out these numbers is that they're all over the map. So let me first write the analytical expressions. This is a half, and of course the standard model doesn't couple to right-handed neutrinos. This one, so once again, qz is always I3 minus sw squared times q. This is this. For up quarks, and for down quarks, okay. Now, if you have something that's 0.2, you divide it by 3 and you square it, it basically turns into nothing. Whereas these two numbers, if sine squared theta is 1/4, these two numbers would be equal in absolute value. So especially in this column, we're going to get very different answers for all of these. And if you plug in the numbers are this, 0.25, 0.126, 0.144 and 0.185. And here, of course, complete asymmetry, because the standard model doesn't couple to right-handed neutrinos. Here, a rather small value of 15%. Here, a large value of about 94%, 93%. And here, 0.67. So it's quite interesting that each species within a generation of quarks and leptons has its own kind of characteristic coupling to the Z boson, and one which, if you actually go and identify these particles, can be elucidated experimentally. Particularly interesting are the asymmetries, which is supposed to be a small number for the leptons and almost maximal for the bottom quarks. So let's first maybe work out the branching ratios and the total widths, and then try and ask to what extent are these numbers actually reproduced by experiment. So let me maybe first write the formula for the total width of the Z. So it has this prefactor, alpha W mz over 6 CW squared. And then we have to add up all the pieces that are in the S column on this slide. So first of all, three neutrinos with a weight of 0.25. Then three leptons with a weight of 1.26. Two up quarks, because of course the Z is too heavy to decay to the top quark, times 3.1. So this takes into account the number of colors and the QCD radiative of correction, times 1.44. And then three. Actually, this number is really 2.98 for some reason that I will discuss in a moment, the contribution of the down quarks. And when you add it all up, you get a number of 2.49 GeV, which, as we'll see in a moment, is in extremely good agreement with the measured value of the Z mass. So now you can go through and try to also look at different subsets of these numbers. For example, the electron to the lepton to quark ratio tests the ratio of these two numbers. The asymmetries test these numbers. And maybe we have enough time, I can give you a little slideshow on the precision electroweak experiments. So yeah, let's turn on the projector. Okay. Okay, I'm sorry. Meanwhile, I'll erase this blackboard for some ulterior motive. Actually, while we're waiting for that to warm up, let me record some numbers here. Do I have to? Sorry? That's what I just did. That's what screwed everything up. Yeah, there we go. Okay, so first of all, I just have some event displays. How were these pictures taken? Well, the mass of the Z is 91 GeV, which is an energy that was considered in the 1980s to be possible to reach with E plus E minus colliders. There were actually two programs that were done, one at CERN using what's now called the LHC tunnel. At that time, it was the site of a collider called LEP, the Large Electron-Positron Collider. The other way it was done was at SLAC. There was an accelerator built called SLC, which basically operated on the principle that electrons and positrons were accelerated down the SLAC LINAC, brought into two paths, and collided with one another. The LEP experiments eventually collected 12 million, so the process is E plus E minus to a Z to something. The LEP experiments eventually collected 12 million Zs. The SLAC experiments collected only 500,000 Zs, but with electron beam polarization, which is actually a very important feature that we'll see in just a moment. So from my friends at SLAC, here are some event displays from the SLD experiment, which was operating at this facility. So this is E plus E minus to a Z, and then you just watch it decay into things. Now, for LHC, event displays are not very useful for analysis for reasons that we'll discuss in lecture four. Or if I don't discuss it, please ask me. But they're wonderful for visualization. And I guess I encourage people to try and look at event displays and understand exactly what's going on in them. This is a very easy one. Two very straight tracks indicating high momentum charged particles. The histograms here are the energy deposition in an electron and then a hadron calorimeter. So this is just E plus E minus going back into E plus E minus. This is somewhat more interesting. Here you see, again, it's obviously leptons because the event is very simple. A one-prong against a three-prong topology is typically a tau decay. It's something that can be, probably in this case, a pion, a single pion on one side, and an A1 decaying to three pions on the other side. This is what typical quark events look like at 91 GeV. So here you see the collimated tracks that are going to form jets. We're going to talk a lot about the structure of jets in later lectures in this course. Okay. This is a detector model. This is Opal is one of the detectors that was used at LEP. This is actually a very beautiful distribution taken, I think, kind of from the data from the first week in LEP. This is the distribution of the axes of these jets viewed over the LEP program. And as you see, this distribution is cut off in the center, but the shape is beautifully this function 1 plus cosine squared theta that I derived at the beginning of this lecture. So the jets follow the distributions predicted by QED. We'll discuss that a lot more, as I say, later in the course. Now, when you tune the electron positron energy exactly to 91 GeV, plus or minus this 2.5 GeV width, what you see is a resonance. Actually, the cross-section increases by about a factor of 1,000. And in fact, the resonance is very precisely understood because it comes from fundamental physics. We can calculate all aspects of it. It's basically a Breit-Wigner-type resonance with a width that I just predicted on the blackboard for you, shaped, however, by some other effects. For example, when the electrons come into the Z, they can radiate photons. That's so-called initial state radiation. It's what causes this distribution to kind of slough over to larger energies. The red points, can those of you in the front row see that there are error bars on those red points? Represents the measurement of the cross-section by the Opal experiment. The black line is a computation from actually fundamental principles of the shape of the resonance. And you see they're in beautiful agreement. Fitting that out, you actually get a number for the Z width that agrees with the number that I just wrote to three significant figures. So it's really quite impressive. Here is another presentation, the average of the four LEP experiments. The error bars are, measurement error bars are increased by a factor of 10, so you can see them. And what you see between the brown curve and the green curve is the effect of this initial state radiation electroweak correction. Okay. Here's another of these beautiful 1-against-3 tau events. Now, tau is very interesting because tau is a polarization analyzer. It decays through weak decays. And so the distribution of the tau decay product is different depending on whether it's a right-handed or a left-handed tau. Probably the simplest example of that is in the decay. Tau goes to pi minus neutrino. The neutrino produced in weak interactions is always left-handed. So in the tau frame, if the tau is right-handed, if the tau goes this way, has its spin in this direction, the neutrino is always going backwards and the pion is always going forward. If you boost to a highly boosted tau, that means that a hard pion indicates a right-handed tau. If you flip it over, a slow pion indicates a left-handed tau. If you measure the pion energy distribution, you can then determine the tau polarization. And here's the data on the left-hand side of this plot. So the black line is the simulated distribution from a purely right-handed sample of taus. This is a purely left-handed sample of taus. And as you see, there's roughly a 15% asymmetry reflected in the final data, the sum of those distributions, which is the dotted lines. With a little more complicated analysis that I don't have time for here, you can do the same kind of polarization analysis in any tau decay mode. Here's the result for the tau decay to a lepton and two neutrinos, for which the prediction is that the left-handed particles have a slightly harder distribution of muons or electrons. And again, you get this number. And here is a Z decay to BB bar. Well, and in this plot, it only looks like two jets, one here and one here. However, what you have to do is to blow this up so you can see the small circle here. The SLD experiment included a device about this big with CCDs in it that would give you precision vertex information. And when you look at the tracks in that view, what you see is that there's some fraction of a centimeter separation between tracks that came from directly from the Z decay here, tracks that came from a late decaying particle here, and tracks that came from a late decaying particle here. The lifetime of the B meson is 1.5 picoseconds, about 0.5 millimeter. You multiply it by gamma. So this is more or less what you would expect for a Z decay to two Bs. And by looking for that signature, you can pick out the Z to BB bar events. Here is another view of that from the OPAL experiment. So the excess that you see at very long lifetimes here is the Z to BB bar. Now, if I expect a very high degree of asymmetry between left and right, and I have polarized beams, the E left to Z to BB bar should almost entirely have left-handed Bs, and so it should be very strongly forward. The E right to Z to Bs, again, has left-handed Bs, so according to the formulae that I derived at the beginning of the lecture, that should be extremely backward peaked. And here's the data. So indeed, with left-handed polarization, it's very forward peaked. With right-handed beam polarization, it's very backward peaked. It's not perfect because you can't always tell a B from a B bar. But The purple histogram is a Monte Carlo which models that effect, and it's essentially consistent with this over 90% asymmetry for left with respect to right. And okay, I think that's probably all I want to show. Could you just raise this? I'll write a couple numbers on the blackboard and then we'll be done. Okay. Well, let me just write here a few numbers to show once you actually really go at this in a sophisticated way and compute the electroweak radiative corrections, how well you do comparing the results of these experiments to theory. So for example, RL, so this is the hadron to lepton ratio in Z decays. The formulae that I wrote give a number of 20.6. When you compute the radiative corrections and use the best fit value of sine squared theta W, you get this theoretical prediction, and here is the experimental value. If you look at RB, so this is the ratio of Z to B, B bar, divided by Z to hadrons, all hadrons. The number I predicted was actually 0.22, but it turns out that there's an important radiative correction that has to do with the top quark. And when you include that, this number gets turned into 0.23. The completely radiatively corrected value is 0.21562 with an error of 13 in the last decimal places. And the experimental value is 0.21629 with an error of 66. So within one sigma, and actually it's a fantastically accurate experiment. The gamma z, I predicted in this simple analysis 2.49. The value with one loop radiative corrections is 2.4965 with an error of 15. And the experimental value is 2.4952 with an accuracy of 23. I could go on. Actually, I will go on. The AE, I'll tell you about later, A tau, and AB. A tau, I explained to you how it's done. The simple value is 0.15. The radiatively corrected value is 0.1480. The value observed from the experiments that I showed you, the combination from four LEP experiments, is this. One can also measure the lepton polarization using polarized beams. That is, just take a left-handed versus right-handed electron beam. There should be a 15% asymmetry in the whole rate for producing Zs. So you just basically change the polarization of the beam, and somewhere down there, 3 miles away, you count Zs. That experiment was done at SLAC to give it's the same prediction, and it got the number 0.513. 21. AB, I explained to you how that was done. My simple calculation gave 0.93. The value with, again, complete one loop radiative corrections is 9346 with a very small error, and 0.923 with an error of a couple percent is what's measured. So I guess the moral of all this is that formula that I wrote up there for you, which I claim is the general expression of the coupling of the electroweak interactions to quarks and leptons, really is a fantastic formula. When applied with kind of the full power of our modern ability to compute Feynman diagrams, it gives predictions that are in truly remarkable agreement with the precision study of the ZDKs. And so this at least is one very strong rock that we can stand on when we try to understand what physics is beyond the standard model. This SU2 cross U1 theory is very elegantly verified in these experiments. So that's a good place to stop today. Thank you very much. I'm sorry. There was one more thing that I should have said.
Unclap,
yes, which is to write down the Z branching ratios. And as like the W branching ratios, these come up in LHC physics. And so it's good to have the table of these in your head as well. And so if you'll unclap just for a minute, let me just write those on the blackboard, and then I'll take some questions. So for LHC physics, the Z is a very important object, as we'll discuss later. And so to understand its branching ratios is extremely important. The branching ratios for a neutrino, an electron, or a muon, or a tau, a U, or a D, are the following. This is 6.7%. So if I multiply it by 3, it's 20%. This is a very important number for LHC. 20% of Zs are invisible. This number is 3.3%. If you multiply it by 2, it's 6.7. So it says that only less than 7% of Zs are identifiable in the way that you identify Zs at the LHC. And then for the rest, this number here is 11.9%. And this number is 15%. So Zs, in particular, Z to BB bar, is about a 15% decay mode. And that's often either a very important signal or a very important background when you start doing LHC physics. So in the same way as you commit the W boson branching ratios to memory, I think it's very important to commit these numbers to memory. And they will be coming up when we talk about the real properties of LHC events. Okay, please excuse me. Now I'm really done. Oh, this is just E and mu. Yeah. Taus are more subtle. Okay. So I've dumped a lot of information on you. Can I answer any questions? Yes.
Was SLC able to produce polarizations of any kind? Like, was it like 100% polarization, or were we like, did they have some kind of amount that they were able to do?
Okay, well, so you could produce a 90% polarized, longitudinally polarized electron beam. So a 90% polarization is 95% E left and 5% E right. I think for the next generation for ILC, people are talking about 80% with much higher intensity. So it's easier to produce more polarization if your intensity is lower. 90% that's a whopping polarization. Now, could it be in any direction? Well, this is actually interesting. If you have a polarized beam and you take it around a corner, synchrotron radiation can be polarized. And it can bring you from one polarization state to another. So longitudinal polarization is not stable in a circular collider, or even it's not stable in a circular arc. However, if you only go around one arc, there's a small motion of the polarization. It turns out that there's a cancellation between the there's a cancellation between the effect of the magnetic field and Thomas precession, which causes the polarization rotation to be proportional to G minus 2. And so it's a relatively small polarization when you go around an arc once. And so this was actually used in order to align the polarization at the vertex. The SLC had some setup where here was the LINAC, and then there were two arcs, and then the collider hall was here. And so they used the G minus two precession in the arc to align the polarization to a longitudinal direction at the collision point. In principle, if you wanted transverse polarization, you would do some different beam gymnastics and cause the polarization to line up in a transverse instead of a longitudinal direction. It was thought that that was not a useful thing to do. I think that's correct. Okay, the important thing is that linear acceleration as opposed to circular acceleration preserves longitudinal polarization exactly. And so that's the thing you're using in this setup. That's why they couldn't do it at LEP. Okay, other questions? Okay, well, as I say, I've dumped a lot of information on you, so think about it. It's all written up in those lecture notes that I cited there. And if you have questions, I'll be around all week, so don't just feel free to ask me anything. Thank you very much.
So a few things. There is a library downstairs. So if you need any kind of refresher about quantum field theory or relativistic kinematics and things like that, you can always go downstairs and pick up a book. There is even a book by someone called Peskin there. I'm sure it has all those formulas. So feel free. The library is open. The second thing is we have a coffee break now until about 11, so you have enough time to discuss any of those things. The only thing we request is that you do come back here more or less sharply at 11. Okay? That's it.
Okay. Good.